Sunday, I started this series I call Run to the Roar, embracing the things that make us afraid. The scripture text is actually out of 1 Samuel when David confronted Goliath in the Valley of Elah. One translation said that the Philistine, after he cursed David by his gods, that he roared against him. And the scripture said that when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. He didn't run away. Here's a giant that is twice his size in height and probably three or four times his size in weight, probably 10 feet tall, with a spear that's taller than David, trained warrior, and he's roaring against him. But instead of shrinking back, he ran to the roar, embracing the things that make us afraid. Last week we talked about the principal one is this issue of vulnerability. Vulnerability. I talked about one of the things that I enjoy doing is helping train people and mentor people and watching people grow and kind of getting them out of their shell and watching them blossom and bloom. And the one thing that you almost always have to do initially is overcome their fear. They want to stay in the shell. They like to stay small and hidden. And that fear has a name. That fear is vulnerability. It comes from a word that means to wound. And to be vulnerable means to be capable of being wounded. And not only physically, and in most cases, probably for us, it's more emotional wounds than anything else. And I took you to this well-known quote from Theodore Roosevelt, a former president. And he said this. This is a tremendous quote. He said, "It's not the critic who counts. Not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly." Daring greatly. That's what I'm trying to encourage you to do. To come out of the shell, get in the arena, live courageously, and dare greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. Can I give you a quick reminder? We're talking about vulnerability. We're talking about this issue. It's the quality of state of being exposed to the possibility of being attacked or harmed, either physically or emotionally. It involves three things. Vulnerability involves uncertainty, it involves risk, and it involves emotional exposure. Uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. When we encounter those things, we feel vulnerable, open to attack. Either emotional, there's a risk, there's an uncertainty, emotional exposure. We gave you some examples. Let's run through. Sharing an unpopular opinion. You're in a group of people and everybody has one opinion and yours is the opposite. And so we just keep quiet. Now let me pause and say, I'm not suggesting that you need to say everything you think, and there are times when it's wise to keep quiet, okay? But the decision to keep quiet should be made on the basis of your wisdom rather than your fear of speaking out. Do you understand the difference? You don't need to fight every battle. Am I willing to die on this hill? Choose your battles carefully. And some things you need to ignore. It's a thing of wisdom and the best thing to do. But that decision is different when it's made because of wisdom and tact, rather than the fact that you are feeling vulnerable, at risk, and emotional exposure. What kind of emotional exposure? Censure, people criticize you, people come against you, people rail against you. You see it every day on Facebook and Twitter, these Facebook and Twitter wars, and people can be so mean. Sharing an unpopular opinion. And that's, you'll also notice that we do a thing called impression management. Impression management is the things we say before we say what we want to say to manage the impression we're going to make when we say it. Well, you know, I might be wrong about this, and maybe I'm the only one who feels this way, but those are the things we say before what is called impression management. It's a sign of our feeling of vulnerability. Starting a new business, is that risky? Yes. Is it uncertain? Yes. Emotional exposure? Yeah. If you fail, people may criticize you, call you a loser, a failure. sharing something you've created. Sharing something you've created. Here it is to the world, and now you're exposed to their response, to their evaluation. Singing in front of people. Speaking in public. One of the biggest fears that people have is speak. Why? Because the focus is on you're really out there. Preaching a sermon. Feel vulnerable every time I stand up. There's a possibility somebody's going to hear something I'm not saying. I could be misunderstood. I could make a mistake. I may offend someone. There's a certain risk and emotional exposure there. You know, like the preacher got through the preaching, and at the door, a guy said, "Pastor, that was a good sermon until you got a hold of it." Teaching a class, same thing, just a different platform, a different venue. Leading in worship. You might mess up. You might hit the wrong chords. You might go to the wrong place. You might get to worshiping so hard you quit looking at the music and don't even realize you're on the wrong fret. Trying something new, especially if it's goes against the traditional line of thought and the popular wisdom of the day. Admitting you're afraid. Admitting you don't understand. In class, you sit there and you're the only one that doesn't understand, and then finally you have the courage to speak up and you find out half the class didn't understand it either, but nobody wanted to say anything. Why? Because there's this fear of, I'm vulnerable. Falling in love. Oh yeah, that's always risky. Is it uncertain? Absolutely. I mean, your emotions, your heart are out there. Will you promise me tonight you're going to treat me right if I give my heart to you? Lyrics of a country song. Being the first to say I love you. The other person may say, well, that's nice, but I think we should date other people. Ooh. A job interview. Sharing your faith. All of these things are things that are vulnerable, and it's the thing that holds people back. They're afraid to step in the arena. They armor up and hide and stay small because they don't want that possibility, that exposure, the risk, the uncertainty, the emotional exposure that goes with being vulnerable. And it's the first step in moving forward and using your gifts and your creativity, because vulnerability is the birthplace of creativity and using your gifts. I'll show you that in detail in just a moment. There were a bunch of myths that I talked about, but there are two in particular I want to remind you of, and that is there was a myth. Myth number one is that I might be criticized. If I step out and do something, I might be criticized. That's a myth, because the truth is you will be criticized. Don't say I might be criticized. Just get it in your head. I will be criticized. I will be criticized. I'm going to ask you to do something I almost never do. A lot of preachers do it all the time, ask the congregation to repeat something, but I'm going to do it today. I want you to say that out loud. I want you to get it in your mind and understand. Say it with me. I will be criticized. I was teaching camp meeting in South Carolina about 150 years ago, I think it was. And it was the morning Bible study. And when I finished, as I came off of the platform, there was a man standing there waiting on me. And he had been in the big auditorium. He was in the back of the auditorium. He came all the way across the auditorium, was standing at the bottom of the stairs waiting on me. And the expression on his face, you would have thought he was an undertaker. Stern, solemn, standing there waiting on me. As I came down the steps, he stepped up and I reached out my hand to shake his hand. I smiled. How are you, sir? He didn't say hello, good morning, didn't shake my hand. He just grunted. I said, not much of a Bible teacher, are you? I thought, well, thank you for making a guest in your state feel so welcome. That's what I thought. And some of you didn't know that people could be that mean, did you? But they do. That's not the first time. And you have to ask, why would a person, I mean, this guy walks all the way across that room and is standing there waiting his turn to insult me. Why do people feel the need to say and do things like that? I told you last week. I didn't know his name, but I know who he is. Meet Brother Buzzard. I told you, it is the nature of a fly to go to garbage, the nature of a buzzard to go to a dead carcass, and there are just some people who have the nature of a fly and a buzzard. Don't you be that person. So I just looked at him and smiled and I said, you know what? You are really bright. It takes most people 2 or 3 days to figure out that I'm not much of a Bible teacher, but you figured it out in 1 hour. And I went to lunch. And then go home, and I'm going to have to pack my bags and leave now. I don't know. What did I do? I didn't. No. You have to decide whose opinion matters. And that opinion didn't matter. It didn't matter. Get it in your mind. I will be criticized. Say it again. I will be criticized. If you were to walk on water, somebody would criticize you for not being able to swim. The second is that I might fail. That's a myth. The truth is you will fail. Say that. I will fail. You will fail. I believe it was Albert Einstein, let me check my notes here, who said that success is failure in progress. Winston Churchill said, success is moving from one failure to another without losing your passion. Let me tell you about this man. This guy, he had his first job. He was fired from his job as editor of the Kansas City Star newspaper. The reason, because he lacked imagination and had no good ideas. So he started his own company, and his company went bankrupt, and he had to file for bankruptcy. For years, his life consisted of eating beans and driving up debts. And then when he needed funding for a creative business venture, he was turned down by over 300 banks. They all said no. Finally, one bank said yes, and when he launched that business, shortly after that, his employees went on strike and he incurred $4 million in debt. Upon that, he had a nervous and mental breakdown. His name was Walt Disney, who had no imagination and no good ideas. And what's really funny is when he opened Disneyland in Anaheim on July 17, 1955, forged tickets brought thousands and thousands of visitors, more than they anticipated, and added to a line that trailed several miles long. And in July, with temperatures soaring up to 100 degrees, the new asphalt was melting women's high heels, drinking fountains were defunct thanks to a plumber strike, and some of the rides malfunctioned, so the critics blasted Disneyland opening and called it Black Sunday. What a failure. Now here's a question we have. Why does this fear of vulnerability have such power over us? Our fear of vulnerability, it keeps us small, it keeps us outside the arena, it makes us afraid to live courageously. I have a song, but I'm afraid to sing it. I have a poem, but I'm afraid to write it. I have an idea, but I'm afraid to try it. I have something to say, but I'm afraid to say it. I want to be involved, but I'm afraid to commit to it. So why is this so? What makes us so afraid? Why are we so fearful of criticism and failure? And we've just said several times that that's certain. Why do we live in fear of what people will think or say? And listen, why do we give the opinions of others so much power over us? Why do you surrender your power to some brother buzzard in your life? Why? And the question is, how can we let ourselves be seen if shame has us terrified of what people might think? And I just said the key word, because vulnerability, you want to know the answer to that, vulnerability is deeply rooted in shame. Shame. I've talked about it before. We're going to talk about it again. We don't want to talk about it, but the less we talk about it, the more we have of it. And everybody here on the sound of my voice at some point in your life has been wounded by shame. Deals with shame, you just didn't know what to call it. But shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that you are fundamentally flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. That one is fundamentally bad, inadequate, defective, unworthy, or not fully valued as a human being. Shame and guilt are not the same thing. Guilt is, I made a mistake. Shame is, I am a mistake. Guilt says, I lied to my mother. Shame says, I can never be what my mother would want me to be. Shame says, you are flawed, worthless, imperfect, and unlovable, and you must do things perfectly or not at all. And that's what drives perfectionism. And wherever you see that kind of perfectionism, usually it is typical, a characteristic, an evidence of a shame-based situation of toxic shame. Having, and I'll talk about that later. So do you feel that no matter what you do, someone else could do it better? That's shame. Do you feel that you have to work twice as hard to be half as good? That's shame. Do you feel that other people have what it takes, but you don't have the right stuff? That's shame. That you're the only caterpillar in a world filled with butterflies? That's shame. It is the sense of being uniquely and hopelessly flawed, feeling different and less valuable than others. The nagging feeling that you just don't measure up. The vague sense of what I call not good enoughness. Not good enough. I'm not a good enough mother. I'm not a good enough father. I'm not a good enough student. I'm not a good enough employee. I'm not a good enough singer. I'm not a good enough musician. I'm not a good enough teacher. I'm not good enough athlete. I'm not good enough. That's what we're talking about. And in clinical terms, they refer to this as scarcity. Not good enough. Scarcity. I'm not good enough. Not good enough. That you're flawed and inferior in every way. That nothing about you is okay. And while you can reflect, and maybe even if you have a friend, talk about it, but most people don't. We kind of cover this up. But deep down inside, you can absolutely just beat up yourself. You have no self-compassion. You may be very compassionate for other people who have stepped into the arena. We talked about that and are vulnerable and they've failed or stumbled. We have great, but we don't have much self-compassion. We're not very compassionate with ourselves. In fact, we probably the most brutal critic you may have is your own self-talk. And when you can just beat up on yourself and always talk about where you fail, where you fall short, you can never celebrate any victory or any gift or anything good that you do in your life. Completely overshadowed. Overshadowed. And a CPE supervisor, he said, Ryan, you write a verbatim, that's a report for this group, this training thing. You can always point out where you made mistakes, but I never hear you celebrate the good things that you did on this call or visit. He said, learn to own your competence without becoming arrogant. So you can do good things. There's things that you do well. And I know you don't want to sound braggadocious, I understand that, you know, that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. We let others speak well of us. But can you own your giftedness? If not, you're just terribly wounded by shame that there's nothing okay with you. Shame screams, I don't have what it takes. I'm not enough. There's something wrong with me. I'm bad. I don't matter. I'm not important. I'm insignificant. I've seen it 100 times in the ministry. Pastors, for example, go to a pastor's conference. And it's a training conference. And they bring in, you know, some 10-talent guy who talks about how all the success that he's had. And I've seen it. I've heard it. And they leave thinking, you know, I celebrate and I rejoice at all the good things that are happening, the success he's had, but what's wrong with me? That's shame. What's wrong with me? He has what it takes. I don't have what it takes. And you know, that's part of the reason why about 1,200 evangelical pastors are leaving the ministry every month in America. Did you hear that? I don't mean going to another church. They're leaving to sell Amway or insurance or used cars. There's this deep wounding of shame. I don't have what it takes. I don't measure up. That's what shame is all about. Gershon Kaufman said that shame is without parallel, a sickness of the soul, an assault on our essential dignity. None other than Charlie Chaplin said, the trouble with the whole world is that we despise ourselves. I don't think he's missed the mark. I don't think it's far off. We don't think of it in those terms. There are Christians who think that God is always mad at them. That God is always disappointed in them. I don't pray enough. Hear it? Not enough. Scarcity. I don't pray enough. I don't read my Bible enough. I don't share my faith enough. Always. That God is always disappointed. The idea that God could be pleased with them is foreign from their thinking. That He groans when He sees them coming. There's a perpetual frown on His face. That God is perpetually disappointed in you. And there may be times when we do things that disappoint the heart of God. Do your kids, your children, your grandchildren do things that disappoint you? Yes. Does it change how you think about them? Are they now worthless and unworthy of being loved because they've made bad choices and disappointed you? Of course not. And somehow we just can't trans. God is a better parent than we are. And the idea that God could just be crazy about you, it is shame that says, no, I'm unworthy, I'm unlovable. Listen to this. This was an anonymous woman, an anonymous quote from a woman. Listen to this. She said, I seldom feel any joy about who I am. Ooh, that is deep, deep shame. And there are a lot of people, maybe some of you, now that's not the kind of thing that you post or that you talk about, but way down inside, I seldom feel any joy about who I am. Because, and there's a reason for that, and I'm getting to it. It's because we have the wrong criteria, we have the wrong idea, the wrong measurement about worth and value. Now, can't you see how this deeply, deeply wounded by shame, how this connects to vulnerability and how it feeds it and reinforces it? Wounded by toxic shame, we have this poor estimation of ourselves. We have no self-confidence, no positive self-image, so we're insecure about who we are, so the opinion of others become paramount. This makes us vulnerable to criticism and failure, and since the disapproval of others must be avoided at all costs, I dare not step into the arena where the disapproving eye of the crowd might see me, because their criticism and my failure will only confirm what I already believe about myself, that I'm flawed, I'm not good enough, so I will avoid the pain of that by hiding and not trying. I'll armor up and stay small. That makes sense? We can't let ourselves be seen if we're terrified by what people will think. What people think become the measurement of our worthiness, and letting the expectations of others define us. I figured out a long time ago as a pastor, that'll drive you crazy. If you pastor 300 people, you've got 300 expectations of who you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to do. You'll be absolutely schizophrenic and ready for the guys with the little white coats. You cannot possibly measure up to everybody's expectations. You can't do that. That's absolutely impossible to do. We let the thoughts of others define, the expectations of others define who we are. And right now I'm thinking about when you go to those conferences, you know, and you register and there's a table there, and after you sign in, pay your money, they've got a little name tag and a Sharpie pen, and they want you to write your name on it. Then put it right here. And most of us don't like doing that, but, you know, we'll cooperate. What would it be like, what some people do, what I'm talking about, letting other people's expectations define you. What would it, some people, it's like they give the name, they take the name tag and the pen and put it in the hands of everybody at the conference and let them write your name on it. Let them say who you are. You know, the expectations of others, your mother-in-law, your friends, your job, your other people. Why don't you take the pen back? Take it back. Why do you let them define who you are? Why don't you take the pen back? And why don't you put that pen in God's hands and let Him write your name and let Him tell you who you are? Let Him define you. Prodigal son left his father's home, a loving father. He went out looking for love where it can never be found. And I am the prodigal when I search for love and acceptance where it cannot be found. I am the prodigal when I allow anything other than God to define who I am. And the culture is very busy every single day trying to define who you are. And that's why it will take an absolute work of the Holy Spirit to dislodge this kind of thinking that is so deeply ingrained in your psyche, in your spirit, and in your heart. So our worth and value as a person is based on how well we perform or what we produce or achieve. Stepping to the arena, living courageously makes us vulnerable to uncertainty and emotional exposure. And when shame has filled us with self-loathing and negative self-assessments of our own selves, stepping to the arena where criticism and failure are certain is the last thing that I'm going to do, because it will only confirm my own sense of not good enough and verify that I am unworthy. And the pain of that is nearly unbearable, so I engage in risk avoidance by staying silent and hiding and putting my light under a bushel. And of course, this stifles creativity because we've hitched our self-worth to our productivity and success. And if this is so, then how our product, whatever it is, whatever we've created, whatever we've done, how it's received and evaluated by others exposes us to shame, risk, and emotional exposure. I mean, what if Walt Disney had let the owner of the Kansas Star define who he was as someone who has no imagination and no good ideas? You have to decide whose opinion matters. And here's how it works. Shame produces fear. Fear produces risk aversion. Risk aversion stifles creativity. It kills innovation with the ultimate effect of the forfeiture of the gifts that you have and the contribution that you could be making to your family, to your friends, to your church, to your community, because you're afraid to step out in the arena. Because Brother Buzzard might say you're not a very good Bible teacher. You can't equate failure and criticism as being unworthy. If that were true, none of us would be. Because we all fail and we're all criticized. And if you do, you will never show up. You cannot embrace vulnerability if shame is suffocating your sense of worthiness and who you are. So living courageously and daring greatly it's not saying, well, I'm willing to run the risk of criticism and failure. No, no. It's knowing that you will be criticized and that you will fail and you show up anyway. Knowing that you may get your teeth kicked out. That's running to the roar. Embracing the thing that makes you afraid. So as I close, let me talk to you a little bit about this idea of unworthiness. We tend to define things by what they're not. We tend to define things by what they're not, and that is especially true when we define ourselves by what we are not. And worthiness says, I am not enough. I want you to look at this and just fill in the blank. Never what enough? Never good enough. Never smart enough. Never thin enough. Never pretty enough. Never educated enough. Never rich enough. What goes in the blank in your life? What goes there? Not successful enough. Never enough. That is the language of unworthiness. And we are hyper aware of lack, that we don't have enough. For some folks, it starts before you even get out of bed, before your feet hit the floor. Your first thought is, I didn't get enough sleep. And through the day, I don't have enough time. I didn't get enough done. And we're constantly calculating how much we have, how much we need, how much we want, how much we don't have, and how much everyone else has. I don't have enough. I'm not enough. I'm talking about embracing the things that make us afraid. And believe it or not, one of the things that we're afraid to embrace is our own sense of worthiness. That's understandable, isn't it? We avoid it and move away from it because it kind of smacks of narcissism. You know who Narcissus was? He was the guy in Greek mythology that saw his reflection in the water and fell in love with his own image. And narcissism is this extreme self-love. It's arrogant and conceit. So we don't want to go there and talk about that we're worthy because it may seem arrogant, conceited. It seems to be the opposite of humility and meekness. And I get that. I understand that. And there's something really repulsive about braggarts, but that is not what I'm talking about. And the church has unwittingly instilled the idea of unworthiness by our own careless use of language. I've done it in the past. I'm going to do it again. But how many times have you often said in the context of church, either in a sermon or a testimony or song, you'll hear people say, and it sounds like humility, but you'll hear people say, I'm unworthy. Do you realize what that means? You know what the word unworthy means? It means having no worth. Unworthy means you are worthless. It is correct to say, I am undeserving. That's where grace comes in. I am undeserving. But it is not right to say, I am unworthy. Because that means you have no worth. That means that you are worthless. Jesus said and taught that the value of one soul is of greater worth than all the riches and wealth of the world. For what shall it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul? One soul. Just a few weeks ago, we sang about it. O Holy Night. Long lay the world in sin and error pining till He appeared and the soul felt its worth. John 3:16 proclaims it. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, whosoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. God doesn't think you are worthless. God thinks you have worth. Did you think that Jesus went to the cross because you were worthless? The cross declares your worth, the value that God places upon you. And this whole thing that we're worthless, that is one of shame's most powerful, debilitating lies. That we are worthy. That we are unworthy. And our sense of unworthiness breeds a shame, listen, a shame-based fear of being ordinary. We have the idea that we have to be extraordinary. Shame-based fear of being ordinary arrives out of the sense of having no worth. That to be significant and worthy, we have to be extraordinary. I mean, come on. I will guarantee you the most influential, meaningful, significant people in your life were probably pretty ordinary people like your mother, your father, your friends. Just ordinary people. That we have to do something fantastic as defined and measured by the world. Jesus said, whoever is greatest among you, let him be the servant of all. That's the kingdom's definition of greatness. That's extraordinary. What? Being a servant, which means anybody can be great. Not in the eyes of the world, but in the eyes of the kingdom. And a lot of the stuff that the world says is great isn't great at all. And in the light of eternity, it doesn't mean anything. You know, today's the Super Bowl. And everybody's, you know, talking about the Super Bowl, winning the Super Bowl. Who won it 3 years ago? Anybody? Probably the Patriots, right? Good guess. I don't even remember who won it last year. Was it the Patriots? I don't remember. Nobody remembers a runner-up. Hardly ever. And they started the pregame stuff yesterday. All week they've been doing it. In the light of eternity, it won't mean one thing. And yet the simplest act of kindness, of caring and loving, even giving a cup of cold water, Jesus said, there's a reward there that will not be lost. The problem is that we have bought in hook, line, and sinker to the lies of the culture that define what greatness is and what worthiness is based upon. And I'm as only as good as the culture says I am. I'm only as good as the number of likes I get on Facebook. So we live this performance-driven life, driven to perform, defined by the world standard of greatness. So what makes us really worthy? Where does this worthiness come from? It is inherent worthiness. Pastor, we've been here before. You've done this before. I have. But you don't remember it. When I show it to you again, some of you will remember it. And if I'll do it maybe 15, 20 more times, we will remember it. And there are people here today who weren't here when I did it before. But this is a key and important point. You're asking, where's the Bible in all of this? That's where we're going. That's where we're going. If you talk to any appraiser, they will tell you there are five things that determine the value of anything. What determines value and what makes us worthy? The value of anything is determined by, number one, creativity. Who made it? Who created it? If you give me paintbrushes and a canvas, and I put paint on the canvas, it's worthless. But if Vincent van Gogh put that paint on the canvas, it's worth millions. If Monet put it on there, or Rembrandt, it is worth millions and millions of dollars because of who created it. Secondly, is rarity. One of a kind, limited edition, the only one in the world. You know, rarity. has great, great value to it. The third one is durability. How long will it last? That's why certain automobiles, for example, Mercedes, BMWs, and other automobiles have a higher resale value because they have a reputation for durability and being able to last. And that's why they're considered to have so much more value, the durability of it. And the fourth thing is potential. What can it become? We just were shocked this last week, last Sunday, in fact, over the sudden and tragic death of Kobe Bryant. And I remember Cameron and I actually saw him play one of his first games. The Lakers came to Fresno and played an exhibition game against the Mavericks. And we saw Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant playing together maybe for the second time. Cameron went to see Shaq and I went to see Kobe. Why did the Lakers take him right out of high school at 18 years old and pay millions of dollars? Was he as good at 18 as he was at 30 when he was most valuable player? And after? No, he wasn't. He wasn't, but what did they see? They saw potential. They were right. They saw the potential in that kid, and they were willing to pay for it. Now, let me ask you something. What makes you worthy? Apply this criteria. Forget what the world says about what makes you worthy and makes you valuable. Forget what your daddy told you when he said you'll never amount to anything. Here, you want to know what God says about it? Here's what comes from Scripture. Let me ask you. Creativity. Who made you? You are fearfully and wonderfully made, created in the image and likeness of God. And if you take everything else off of that screen, that alone is enough to give you infinite worth and value because of who made you. And God doesn't make junk. Inherent. And that's why the homeless guy on the bench with three coats and a shopping cart full of junk, he has value and worth because buried beneath the dirt and the rags is the image of God. Yes, marred by sin, but being restored through salvation and redemption one day to be ultimately restored when we see Jesus as He is and we're like Him. Creativity. Who created you? You're created in the image and likeness of God. Rarity. Oh, you say, but there are what? 8 billion people on earth, but there's not another one like you. Your fingerprints are unique. There's no one. Your DNA is unique. There's not another person out of 8 billion that is exactly like you. You want to talk about durability? I know. This body, it wears down. Mine's wearing down a little bit every day. I really thought it would take longer to get this old. But it got here. But see, you are not your body. Your body's just a spacesuit you live in. You have an eternal soul. You want to talk about lifetime warranty? This is not a lifetime. This is for all of eternity. You're durable. You will live forever. Potential. You say, well, I don't have any of that. There you go. Shame message speaking to your soul. And you believing it. I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough. That's what you're saying when you say that. And yet there's potential in you, giftedness in you that God has given there that's untapped because you are so afraid to step out in the arena because Brother Buzzard may say something bad about you. Potential. You said there were five. There are five. And this one, more than any other thing, you ask any appraiser. While all of these are true, there is one thing more than any other that determines the wealth of or the value of anything, and it is this. What is someone willing to pay for it? You could have a classic car that's worth $100,000, but if you can't find somebody to pay you $100,000, guess what? It's not worth $100,000. What is someone willing to pay for it? What was God willing to pay for you? What was Jesus willing to pay for you? Your salvation, your redemption cost God His Son. It cost the Son His life, the richest blood ever shed, the deepest groanings ever groaned, and it was paid for you. You are created in the image of God. You're rare. There's no one exactly like you. So your contribution, your gift is unique. So stop this comparison and trying to be like everybody else. I just finished reading a book called The Gifts of Imperfection. I needed to read that. The Gifts of Imperfection, the subtitle was Stop Trying to Be Who You Think You Should Be So You Can Be Who You Really Are. Wow. That's the contribution. Rarity. You're the only one. Durability. Your soul, it will last forever. The potential that is still there, that's just buried, that's hidden behind your armor. And the highest price ever paid for anything was paid for you. So God says that you have worth, that you are worthy. Undeserving? Oh yes, we're undeserving. I'm so undeserving. But in the eyes of God, unworthy? No way. No way. And here it is. I am imperfect. I am flawed. I make mistakes. But I am worthy of being loved and having connection with others. I am worthy. And when you have that sense, Brother Buzzard's criticism just kind of rolls off of you and you go to lunch. You go to lunch. It brings a sense of self-confidence. And it's not rooted in narcissism or human arrogance, but understanding that this is a precious gift that God has conferred upon you and upon me. I'm through. I want to pray with you. Stand. Everybody, please. Abraham ran to the roar when God said, leave your country and go out into a place where I'll show you. He was vulnerable. And had it not been for that, there would have been no nation of Israel. Moses ran to the roar when God said, leave Jethro's flocks and go back to Egypt. I know there's a warrant for your arrest, but go back because I need you to set my people free. He was vulnerable, but he ran to the roar and stepped into the arena. And without it, Israel would not have been emancipated. Esther ran to the roar when her uncle came and told her about Haman's plot to destroy the Jews, and you've got to go into the king, even though it's risky, because if you go in without being invited, it could cost you your life, especially in the cultural context of another queen that was so arrogant and presumptuous as to defy the king and was deposed. This is really risky, and Esther says, I will go to the king, and if I perish, I perish. She ran to the roar, was vulnerable, and without it, Haman would have destroyed the nation of Israel. David, our subject, ran to the roar with Goliath. Disciples ran to the roar when they left the familiar and secure fishing nets and fishing business they'd had all their life to follow an itinerant carpenter from Galilee and to be his disciple. Paul ran to the roar when he heard a call on the Damascus Road and said, I've chosen you. And he left behind. His career track was headed to the top of the Pharisee world. He was on track. He was to be the top dog. He was excelling above all of his companions. And what did he do? He chose the path of uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure and became vulnerable. And without it, we wouldn't have the New Testament because he wrote most of it, and in his writings shaped the whole flow and the course of Western history in the writings of Paul. And Jesus ran to the roar in the garden when he said, Father, not my will, but yours be done. When they came with swords and staves to take him, could have called 10,000 angels. And I imagine in my fertile imagination, I can imagine thousands of angels standing by with their hands on their swords, waiting for the command, and they would have turned earth into an ash heap. But the command never came because Jesus was in love with a fallen race and a fallen planet. So instead of running away, he ran to the roar and he endured the cross. And without it, oh, where would we all be? Wouldn't it be great to live free of this kind of fear and this kind of torment? Wouldn't it be great to be free from that? Wouldn't it be great? You can be. You can be. You just have to give up the lies that you've been told all of your life, the culture, maybe even your family, or if you've heard all of your life, you have to forget that. You have to transform to the truth and believe the truth about what God says about you and embrace a sense of worthiness. Yes, I'm flawed. Yes, I'm imperfect. Yes, I make mistakes. And I'm worthy of being loved. God said so. God thinks so. And if God thinks so, why can't I think so? Without being arrogant, without being conceited. In fact, it does just the opposite for me. It doesn't make me proud. It makes me humble. It just makes me amazed that God, someone like me, would confer such grace upon my life to say that you are worthy of my love. You are worthy of my love. You are worthy of my son. You are worthy of his life, his blood, his suffering. Some people embrace the idea of worthiness. Okay, I'm worthy. But I'd be more worthy if I could lose 15 pounds. I'd be more worthy if my ears weren't so big. If my nose wasn't so prominent. I'd be more worthy if I could lose these love handles. I'd be more worthy if I had a college degree. I'd be more worthy if I made more money. I'd be more worthy if I had a better job. I'd be more worthy if I had a bigger house. I'd be more worthy if I had this achievement or that accomplishment. No, you're going right back into the message of shame. You saw what determines your worthiness. Now walk in that. Believe the truth. Because it is true. Amen.